Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dale, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Well, as rates have risen over the last 2 years, interest in fixed income is back. And I say that very literally. We get so many queries now about defensive assets, very specifically fixed income, hybrids, bonds, credit products, all of these things. For more than a decade, we saw absolutely no interest in this stuff. And suddenly it's all anyone wants to talk about. It's very, very interesting, but also I think an area that most, certainly NAB trade investors and retail investors, are just less familiar with than they could be. So today I'm joined by Chris Joy, the Portfolio Manager and Chief Investment Officer at Coolabah Capital. He's very well known to many of you. He writes for The Fin. I know many of you follow him closely, to discuss what's been happening in the world of fixed income, what investors should be looking out for, and as always, the outlook for interest rates, which is driving so much of this. Chris, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Gemma, for having me. It's great to be back.
It is so exciting. I mean, we used to talk rates really more than anything else, but now really investors are turning their minds back to defensive assets and so much more interested and excited in putting their money to work in an asset class or set of asset classes that have just been ignored. Kind of start with bond markets, if you don't mind, partly because when we spoke last, bond markets had had a terrible time, even though rates had been going up. If you looked at the total return, it was terrible. And then the last 6 months have been great. What's been driving all of that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, if we go back in time to 2021, the RBA cash rate was 0.1%. Today, it's 4.35%. So what that means is a CBA senior bond in 2021 was probably paying you a total interest rate of about 0.35% a year. Today, that same CBA bond is paying you a total interest rate as high as about 5.35% a year. So that's for a senior bond. And one notch down the capital stack, we have what is known as subordinated bonds or tier two bonds. So we take the same sort of framework and go back to 2021. Tier two was paying you an all-in interest rate of about 1.35%. Today, Westpac's got a tier two bond issue. I've actually bid for $200 million of it. And it's paying an all-in interest rate on the floating rate version of that bond. I kind of pause there because there's actually a fixed rate version and a floating rate version, and they're paying slightly different yields. But the floating rate version will probably end up paying about 6.25% interest versus a 1.35% interest rate back in 2021. And then finally, we have hybrids, a further step down the capital stack. So hybrids are not bonds. They don't pay interest. They pay what are known as distributions, basically like dividends, but they rank ahead of bank shares or equity in the capital stack. And hybrids back in 2021 were paying, again, all-in yields of about 2.1%, 2.2%, whereas today you're probably getting about 7 or close to 7 percent from a hybrid. So kind of 5 to low 5. So senior bonds, circa 6 for tier 2 bonds and around 7 for hybrids. So the yields that are available in the market, Gemma, have improved dramatically. I guess that's the first key point. The reason they've improved is because the RBA cash rate has lifted from 0.1% to 4.35%. We'll talk about it later, but obviously, you know, nobody knows if the RBA is going to hike again or cut next. That's a live debate. What we do know is bond markets have got it horribly wrong consistently. Back in December 21, you know, the bond market was saying that the Federal Reserve in the US would only lift interest rates to 1%. That was going to be the peak in the hiking cycle over the years ahead. And the Fed was also at basically, you know, circa 0.25% back in 2021. Today, the Fed's at 5.25 to 5.50%. So it's lifted interest rates a lot further than markets thought they would. Last year, markets thought the Fed could cut by as much as a full percentage point or 100 basis points from, say, 5.25 to 5.5 to 4.25 to 4.5. And that was last year. And then in January this year, the market was saying the Fed was going to cut by as much as 1.75 percentage points. And recently they've paired that all the way back to just 0.75 percentage points, or from 175 basis points of cuts to 75 basis points of cuts. You mentioned that, you know, bonds did badly. So I think it's important to unpack that statement. Fixed rate bonds did very badly when bond yields increased. If you lock in your interest rate via a term deposit, like a five-year term deposit or a five-year fixed rate bond, you do worse if yields increase and you've locked in the yield. If yields increase, you could have got a higher yield, so you do worse. And actually, in the case of a fixed rate bond, the price of the bond will fall. Conversely, you do well if yields fall and you locked in a higher yield. Now, floating rate notes, which are not fixed rate bonds, they have interest rates that go up and down with the RBA cash rate. So floating rate notes in the 12 months to June 22 did a return that was basically pretty close to zero, plus or minus a bit, whereas fixed rate bonds fell peak to trough, I think, I'm testing my memory a little bit here, but I think peak to trough around that period, mid-22, the peak to trough loss on fixed rate bonds in Australia was about 13%. So you're 100% right. Fixed rate bonds did badly. Floating rate notes didn't do wonderfully. But given that US equities fell between 26 and 36% peak to trough from their highs in 2021 through to mid-22, you know, floating rate notes actually were pretty resilient, as were actually hybrids, interestingly. But you're 100% right. What we've seen is a surge in demand, like just a huge structural shift. This is something that we expected in 2021 because we thought interest rates would lift much more sharply than the market expected. We thought in fact, my chief macro strategist, Kieran Davies, presented internally modeling that said that the RBA needed to get to 4 to 5%. They're now 4.35, and the Fed needed to get to 5 to 6%. And he gave us that presentation in December 21. So we weren't surprised by the big increases in interest rates. We weren't surprised by the poor performance of fixed rate bonds. And we also thought that the whole world was long equities and long illiquidity. So whether you look at mums and dads who have a lot of stocks, you look at pension funds that are basically listed equities, commercial real estate, venture capital, private equity, private debt, and high yield risky debt or junk bonds, they didn't have any cash and they didn't have any safe, what we call high grade bonds, like bank bonds. And that's true universally. So I think what we're seeing play out, Gemma, is just this massive structural shift in asset allocation, because bonds have gone from paying nothing to, you know, interest rates of as high as 6 to 7%, which are obviously quite compelling given their very low risk.
I think this is such an interesting topic of conversation, and it's probably worth putting into context for retail investors. I was going to say people like you and me, people like me, let's be honest, you know, where we go, I've got however much I've got to invest, that's $100,000. And I would like a balanced portfolio. I don't want a lot of volatility, but when rates were zero, I don't want 30% of my portfolio or 40% of it in fixed income that's giving me no return. That just can't deliver for me. I've got to live off that if I'm a retiree in particular. And so then I go, well, maybe I'll buy hybrids, or I'll probably buy equities and I'll buy them for yield and hope that the franking credits are going to give me what I need. And we saw this massive shift in individuals moving up the risk curve, particularly saw it in SMSFs, which is sort of the best data set for what individuals are doing with a total portfolio. It's quite amazing. At one point, sort of 27% was in cash and TDs. It's a bit of argument about why that is and if it's a 30 June issue, but it seemed to be consistent for many years. And it fell to less than 20%, like this massive shift in asset allocation. But pension funds, as you say, and massive institutional investors did the same thing. And logically, you would assume as rates rise, we'll see the shift back. So you're seeing that now?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, we were running $6 billion in FUM in December 22. We're now running close to $11 billion. So we've seen it amongst our client base, Gemma. But, I mean, you make a really important point. When you think about it, right, the cash rate was at 0.1%. Cash was uninvestable. It offered no return. And then bonds were not paying much above that. So they were also largely uninvestable. I think you're exactly right. I think, you know, much of the investing world after the global financial crisis, with the advent of very low inflation rates, very low interest rates, and then following the pandemic with the emergence of zero interest rates, or even in some countries like, you know, in Europe, negative interest rates, People wanted to get long risk, long equities, property, private debt, junk bonds, VCPE. And if you were living in 2021 and you look at, you know, term deposits paying 0.5%, as I mentioned, you know, tier two bonds only paying 1.35%, hybrids paying 2%. You look at equities, you know, bank stocks were paying, let's say, 5 to 7% with franking. Residential property was giving you 3 to 4%. I mean, that looked really good against a 0% cash rate. A-grade office property was probably paying you about 4.5%. Again, that looked really good compared to zero or negative interest rates. But the existential shift for asset allocators, be they mums or dads, SMSFs, sovereign wealth funds or pension funds, is you need to restructure your portfolio if you want to avail yourself of these, you know, much more compelling interest rates on cash and high-grade bonds. And by high-grade bonds, I mean bonds that basically have little to no liquidity risk and little to no default risk, unless you think CBA is going to default on its bonds. You know, obviously, that's a risk that many people would say is de minimis or, you know, statistically insignificant. So the problem is, though, Gemma, that in the low rates for long paradigm that many bond managers and other people thought would persist or prevail in perpetuity, the investing world, overseas pension funds, Aussie super funds, sovereign funds, mums and dads, they were told that this was going to be a constant, low rates for long. And sadly, we've made portfolio decisions whereby we've got way too much commercial real estate exposure. We've got way too much listed equity exposure. We've got way too much venture capital or private equity exposure. And we definitely got way too much private debt exposure. And the difficulty is, if you're someone like the Future Fund, which is like a $300 billion sovereign wealth fund, which is extremely dependent on illiquid asset classes, they want to pivot or shift, but you can't because you're stuck in these illiquid assets. So that process of adjusting portfolios is likely to be multi-year and long duration, but it's definitely fueling tremendous demand. Like, I'm looking at my screens right now, and Westpac opened up their bond issue. And at the open, there was $2.6 billion in demand. We saw an HSBC, you know, HSBC is not a bond issuer we would normally invest in. They did a tier two bond issue the other day where they attracted $5.8 billion in demand. Now, as at December last year, the biggest book build or the largest demand we'd ever seen for an Australian tier two bond was probably in the $3 to $4 billion range. And yet little old HSBC comes along, which doesn't have much of a presence and brand profile in Australia, and they attract $5.8 billion of bids for their tier two issue, which was a record, bigger than any other major bank. So that is that yield-seeking behaviour of global investors wanting to pick up, you know, 6 to 7% interest rates on bonds rather than take equity risk and get actually inferior yields. So, you know, the dividend yield on Aussie equities with franking credits right now is probably around 5%. So would you rather take equity risk and get a dividend yield of 5% or take CBA or Westpac Tier 2 bonds paying 6%? It's an interesting question.
It's so interesting, and those numbers are astonishing. And I will say we have a small part of our business that deals with wholesale and sophisticated individuals who can buy into some of these types of products, obviously not at the scale you can. And the demand we're seeing there is absolutely crazy. The demand is extraordinary. So I'll ask a really stupid question here. Really stupid, because this is not my area of expertise. But these dynamics that are changing, so there's so much more money flowing into fixed income markets. Is the supply keeping up with the demand, or are yields starting to fall because there's so much demand, everyone's competing?
Yeah, that's actually not a stupid question at all. It's actually a super important question, because as a relative value investor, you know, we are, you know, absolutely obsessed with finding cheap bonds that are paying, in fact, too much interest for their risk. So just to give you some numbers on this, like this Westpac bond, I can say this because we're recording the podcast today, the bond will price today, and by the time anyone's listening to this, it'll all be done and dusted. I don't want to give away my intellectual property is actually the key kind of consideration here, but the fair value for this Westpac bond is probably about 1.85 percentage points above a benchmark for the RBA cash rate, which is called the bank bill swap rate. And that bank bill swap rate is sitting right on the RBA cash rate right now. And so it's at 4.35%. So fair value is about 185 basis points or 1.85 percentage points in interest margin above that. And Westpac has launched the deal at 2.85%. Sorry, did I say 2.85? The Westpac has launched the deal at 200 basis points or 2 percentage points above BBSW. So BBSW is 4.35. So Westpac's notionally offering an interest rate of 6.35. And Westpac, if they do what I expect them to do, which is compress that margin through the book build, through the, all the demand that will come in from investors, they probably will squeeze that margin above BBSW, the bank bill swap rate, from 2 percentage points, I'm guessing, down to 1.9 percentage points. And fair value is 1.85 percentage points. What that means is rather than earning 6.35%, the interest rate they'll end up paying is 6.25. But as I mentioned, fair value is 1.85 percentage points, maybe even 1.8. Let's use 1.8. So fair value is 6.15%. And we might be able to buy it at 6.25%. So there's a little bit of extra margin there for us. That's what we do. And we're doing that every day in US bonds, European bonds, Aussie bonds. So since the start of last year, I've bought and sold about $133 billion of bonds. And in the first 2 months of the year, we bought 82 new bond issues. So the calculus for us, Gemma, in the context of your question is, are these spreads going to get compressed by too much demand relative to supply to such a point that would make something like this Westpac bond issue unattractive? So, for example, if Westpac were to turn around and say, no, we're only going to pay 1.8 above BBSW, as in 1.8 percentage points or 180 basis points, I would say, no, thank you, even though I've currently bid for 200 million at 200 basis points above BBSW. And we're using 20 to 30 mathematical models to price this particular bond issue. So taking a step back, is there enough supply? What we can say with certainty is there's been a huge amount of supply. So in the first quarter of this year, for example, in the biggest bond market in the world, the US bond market, I think in the corporate and bank bond market, there was $190 billion off the top of my head that was issued in the first 3 months. So $190 billion of new bond issues. And the market was expecting about $130 billion US of issues. So there was a truckload more issuance. The explanation is, one, the demand. So the supply is effectively meeting the demand. And then two, bond issuers want to get ahead of the US election at the end of the year because they're worried about Trump coming to power and crazy things happening. Here in Australia, we've seen massive bond supply as well. So I would say there's plentiful supply, but spreads have compressed and bond yields have been chopping around. So to give you, again, some numbers, last year, 10-year government bond yields, which are like the benchmark interest rate, the 10-year government bond yield is kind of a benchmark rate that people think about. That actually kind of bobbed around 4% most of the year. Got as high as 5% in October last year here in Australia. Got as low as, I think, about 3.8%. But it kind of more or less finished the year at 4. And right now we're a bit above 4. So what I would say is governments are issuing lots of bonds and bond yields have actually been pretty stable. But there have been some big movements. So that 10-year yield's gone from 4 to 5 down to 3.7 and right now, or 3.8, and right now it's probably sitting around 4 point, in the US it's at 4.3. Here in Australia, it's more around 4.06 actually at present. So we're still bobbing around that 4% level. So we haven't seen, the short answer to your question is, we have not seen a big reduction in 10-year government bond yields. We have seen a big reduction off the October highs, but over the last 12 to 18 months, they've been sort of pretty static around 4%. That's one answer to the question. The second answer is we haven't seen central banks slashing interest rates. So interest rates kind of peaked in the second half of last year. Interest rates have remained relatively stable. We did see the Swiss central bank cut rates recently. Expectations are central banks will broadly start easing rates in the second half of this year, but no really significant moves at all in what we call the short-term cash rate or the overnight cash rate, which for listeners is kind of the interest rate that influences what rate you get on your savings accounts and also the rate you pay on your home loan if you've got a variable rate home loan. So that's the RBA cash rate. We have seen spread compression, which would imply that there's been a big increase in demand relative to supply. But there's definitely been plentiful supply. Another indication of that is my analysts were forecasting that Westpac would issue this new Tier 2 bond, but I would say the market was not expecting it. So what we're seeing is bond issuers, as credit spreads tighten, as that margin, the credit spread is the interest rate margin above the cash rate that you get paid for lending money to Westpac. So if you lend them money for 5 years by this, by this five-year Tier 2 bond, you're getting paid about 2% above cash in extra interest. As that compresses, bond issuers are opportunistically saying, you know what, we might get some more funding here by issuing more bonds, supplying more securities and raising more money through that process.
Quite extraordinary how much is going on, particularly after the last few years. It's incredible. Wanted to come back. You've mentioned private credit a couple of times, and I really wanted to ask you this question. I was giving a presentation last year, and the speaker before me was representing a private credit fund and made the analogy that lending money to this particular manager to then on-lend to largely property developers, from what I could gather, but that was not explicitly discussed, was akin to lending to a bank, but I think in the context of a term deposit, but that if you lent to a bank, you would be, you know, getting 4%. And if you were lending in inverted commas to his funds, you'd be getting 8% or whatever the story was. And it was one of the more misleading statements I've ever heard. And I sat there going, wow, I think this is a very fair comparison. But you want to talk through what you're seeing in the private credit market and what, how you were feeling about it?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think it's really important to go back to first principles, like what is private debt? So first thing is that private debt didn't exist before 2007 in Australia. It didn't exist. These are non-bank lenders, and they are competing to lend money to borrowers who would approach them to get money because they can't get money from a bank. These are basically subprime borrowers. Some of you may remember the, you know, term subprime loans. They referred to the, you know, global financial crisis. There were subprime home loan borrowers who couldn't get loans from banks, so they went to non-banks. In fact, some banks were doing very risky subprime loans, and that's what actually blew up parts of the non-bank and banking system in 2007, 8, 9, et cetera. So in Australia, we didn't have these private debt guys, these private credit funds that didn't exist prior to the GFC. But one lesson from the GFC is regulators rocked up and said, hey, to the banks, fellas, you've got to stop lending to these, you know, crazy risky borrowers who really shouldn't be getting finance in a lot of instances. And so the regulators restricted banks from making loans to dodgy property developers, to making loans to dodgy commercial real estate borrowers. Those two sectors in particular, based on all the analysis we have over the last 150 years, have been almost singularly responsible for every single bank blow up in Australian history. Back in the 1991 recession, ANZ and Westpac almost blew up. They almost traded insolvent because of their residential development and commercial property exposures. And Australia's banking regulator, APRA, is widely regarded as being arguably the toughest in the world, and it's forced banks to stop lending to these sectors. So there are still those borrowers out there. They want money. And in the zero rates for long world, where, you know, TDs were paying 0.5%, if you set up shop and say, hey, I'm going to raise money and return 5, 6, 7, 8 by lending to resi developers and commercial property owners, I can raise capital. And that's what they did. And there's been an incredible, completely unprecedented explosion of private credit funds in Australia, from nothing in 2007 to hundreds today. And the worrying thing is, Jim, that we actually haven't had a major credit shock or default cycle, it's known as, in Australia since all the way back to the 1991 recession, because the global financial crisis in Australia was incredibly benign. Unemployment barely blipped. It went up into the high 5 percentage point territory, still regarded close to full employment. We didn't have two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth in the GFC. So Australia, you know, was the wonder down under. We were bowed out by the commodities price boom and also China's fiscal stimulus, and we got very lucky in the GFC. But obviously, you know, there are cycles. Cycles are inevitable, and we're going to see a recession at some point. And in those downturns, it's the cyclically sensitive sectors that tend to blow up. And so the banks are actually very safe, but to say that a private debt fund is offering, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8% returns, and that's similar to lending to a bank, is, you know, just a fraudulent completely incorrect statement. You're not lending to a bank that has government guaranteed bank deposits, that has access to infinite RBA lending facilities, that is regarded by both the Commonwealth, the federal government, and the credit rating agencies and global investors as being implicitly government guaranteed in many ways, and that has super high credit ratings. So the four major banks are AA- rated, regarded as four of the strongest banks on planet Earth. So these private debt guys, most of them, if not all of them, have never actually seen a credit shock, a big increase in defaults. They weren't expecting a big increase in interest rates. They are completely unregulated, so they don't have APRA breathing down their necks, forcing them to only make very prudent and risk-averse loans. They're actually doing the opposite. They want to make as many loans as possible because they want to grow their funds under management, to grow their management fees, and in some cases, performance fees. And they want to lend to as many people as possible and hopefully weasel their way through whatever adversity we experience. Now, on the adversity front, it's interesting. Notwithstanding all the rhetoric around soft landings, New Zealand's just had 12 months of negative GDP growth. The UK's just had 12 months of negative GDP growth. Japan has very weak growth. Europe has very weak growth. And if we look at the bankruptcy and insolvency data, it's fascinating, Gemma. 2023 was the worst year for US bankruptcies since 2010. So that's in an economy with very low unemployment, strong wage growth, and very strong economic growth. And one of the reasons the global economy has fared so well in the face of these interest rate hikes is that during the pandemic, consumers saved up enormous cash buffers that they've been able to spend. So US households, as one example, saved up cash buffers that were equivalent to 2 years of extra economic growth, and they've spent all of them. So the reason the US economy was so resilient in 22-23, despite the Fed going from 0.25% to 5.25% to 5.5%, is because US consumers had years of extra economic growth that they spent through these pandemic savings buffers that were the result of cash handouts from governments and lockdowns and not being able to spend money during the pandemic. So coming back to the cracks I was talking about, we've seen the worst year for US bankruptcy since 2010. Insolvencies in Australia, the highest since 2015. Aussie businesses prior to the pandemic owed the Australian Tax Office, the ATO, about $25 billion. Today they owe the ATO more than $50 billion, and the ATO is putting businesses into administration. We're seeing record insolvencies in construction. If you open up the newspapers, you're reading every week about builders and developers going under. And this is just the beginning, because rates are not likely in our view to be cut aggressively. They might be chiseled a bit lower, but the cutting cycle is likely to be shallow, and we're likely to be left with high rates for long, because we have some structural inflation pressures that are going to take a long time to get out of the system. In particular, very strong wage growth is pushing up the cost structure in services businesses, all services businesses, basically anyone not making goods or involved in the production of goods. So accountants, doctors, lawyers, bankers, et cetera. These businesses have suffered massive increases in wage costs, and they're increasing the cost of their services. So services inflation all around the world is running at multiples the central bank inflation targets, which are normally around 2%. So they're running at between 4.5% and 6.5%. In the US, services inflation is running at about 6.5%. And that is keeping overall inflation elevated. For the time being, the other part of the inflation calculations, so one part is services companies, the other is goods producing companies. Now, goods prices have come down because supply chains shut down, goods prices went up, so they rose about 12%. Or goods inflation increased to about a peak of 12%. And then as supply chains have reopened, goods prices come down. And that's pushed inflation down. But as anyone listening would know, inflation is still very elevated. And everyone's cognizant of the fact that wage increases have been very strong. And those wage growth rates in Australia are completely incompatible with the RBA hitting its 2.5% inflation target, which again is why we're likely to see interest rates remain structurally high for years. And this is, I guess, the important message behind that analysis, Gemma, is this is very bad news for zombie borrowers, for subprime borrowers, for risky borrowers, and for these private credit funds. They are likely experiencing very high default rates. They're completely unregulated, so they have no obligation to tell you anything about what's in their portfolios. And 99.9% of them are extending and pretending. What that means is the borrower is about to default on its three-year loan, and the private debt fund turns around and says, "Don't worry, mate, we'll make it a six-year loan." And the default disappears. So they're completely illiquid. The underlying loans have zero liquidity. And we don't think there's much skill in the sector. Now, I don't want to generalize completely. There are obviously good private debt funds out there. You know, one of our stablemates, Metrics, is highly regarded, has 125 staff. But, I think the sector is going to experience tremendous pain. And I think the sector is now struggling because we're hearing that there are 12 private credit funds in distress in Australia as a result of a combination of borrowers not repaying loans and then inflows drying out. In fact, people pulling money out. So, I think that was a beneficiary of the search for yield environment where there was no yield. But now we live in a world of very, very high risk-free yields and it's easily accessible. One final point is I mentioned that Westpac bond issue. As we've been talking, they actually set the interest rate spread at 1.88 percentage points above the bank bill swap rate. I suggested they'd set it at 1.90, so very close. And so that's giving you an interest rate of about 6.13%. But that would be my summary on private debt, John.
That's incredibly useful. Thank you. I think it's just one that has been heavily marketed to retail investors, to mums and dads and to, as I said, people like you and me. And personally, having done a teeny bit of work and used to work in a field looking at funds management and relatively good, I like to think, of being able to work out what's in a portfolio, finding it unbelievably difficult to get any insight into what the actual underlying assets were, which makes me quite uncomfortable. But your analysis is much more valid than that. Not a Google search, something more sophisticated. So you've spoken about rates, and please let's talk about this. I was having a chat with a friend, someone not in the industry, the other day, who was genuinely shocked when he had made the comment that rates are about to come down and that they'll be coming down quite a long way. And I was like, look, that's not our forecast, right? NAB has the first rate cut in their view coming in November, and that was not as soon as he was hoping. And also recently speaking to the Association of Financial Counselors, who are dealing with people in severe financial distress. They often only go to a financial counselor who is a professional in dealing with just helping you out of a bad situation. But people often don't go to see them until they're, at the wall, right? The bank has come and said, we're going to take your house, and then they go get help. I would strongly recommend you go earlier. It was amazing how many of those financial counselors believed that rates were likely to fall soon and fall a long way. And when I was saying to them, that's not our view, they were quite shocked. And certainly a lot of their customers would have been very shocked too. You're also in the not yet camp?
Yeah, I mean, this is a key question, right? Like, where are rates heading? And in late 21, we argued they were going much higher than markets expected. Last year, when the bond market, I mentioned this earlier, was expecting the Fed to cut by 100 basis points or one full percentage point from 5.25 to 4.25. Last year, we said that was completely bogus and rates were going to go higher and they would not be cut last year. And that's obviously what transpired. This year, the bond market was expecting up to 175 basis points of cuts from the Fed. We said that was bogus. The bond market said that they cut in March at one point. We said that was bogus. And it looks like the earliest the Fed will cut is in June. But here's the rub. Don't take my word for it. Just listen to what the Reserve Bank of Australia has actually said publicly. They have said that the normal neutral interest rate in their view is 3.8%. That is the interest rate or the cash rate that you should expect through the cycle. We're currently at 4.35%. That implies the RBA is going to cut a couple of times and that's it, if they're going back to neutral. Now, in Australia, we have solid economic growth, like trend-like economic growth. We have a very low unemployment rate, amongst the lowest it's been since World War II, at 3.7%. We have incredibly brisk wage growth, and we have well above target inflation. So why on earth would the RBA be cutting rates aggressively when inflation's above target, unemployment's low, growth is around trend, and wage growth is brisk? That just seems completely improbable. And the RBA has been guiding people publicly through the financial review and through their media conduits to not necessarily expect much, if any, in the way of rate cuts this year. Now, remember, the RBA is only at 4.35%. This is very unusual. Normally, the RBA has interest rates that are held higher than our peers overseas. So to put that in context, New Zealand's at 5.5%. That's their cash rate. America's at 5.25 to 5.5. Canada's at 5. The Bank of England, Britain, is at 5.25. So Australia rolling the dice with inflation and hoping we can get away with a lower interest rate sadly, when you run the RBA's macroeconomic models as we do, they all say something very emphatically, that the cash rate shouldn't be at 4.35, it should be at 5. So this RBA, I think, has been potentially compromised compromised by those who want to see unemployment stay low. The RBA has a dual mandate. It has to maintain price stability and also deliver full employment. And I think that dual mandate's creating a little bit of confusion, and you've got some, you know, internal conflict about where rates should really be. But there's no argument for lower rates right now in Australia. The only argument is actually for much higher rates. And the RBA's models say they should be at 5. If you don't believe me, listen to Jonathan Gerns, who just spent 28 years at the RBA. He was the head of economic analysis at the RBA. He's now chief economist at Challenger. And he's run the same models, and he said the same thing, that the RBA should be at 5% according to its own analytical framework. But for some reason, they're at 4.35. So if we do get rate cuts, they're likely to be very shallow. I think the central banks are very nervous about reigniting inflation. So we could get, well, I mean, we do think we'll get rate cuts from the Fed and other central banks in the second half of the year, but they're likely to be modest, is our view. And that is something markets are not pricing. Markets are pricing in steeper cuts. I think that the folks you're talking to are hoodwinked potentially by all the hyperbole in the media that we've heard around these steep rate cuts that were being priced by markets on several occasions last year, up to 100 basis points of cuts last year from the Fed, and that were also priced by markets this year. But I think there's a lot of complacency, and in, you know, preparing a budget and analysing your finances and building portfolios, I think it would be prudent to think, if you're an Australian, how would you feel if rates were to climb a little further? And then how would you also feel if rates were not cut by much, by which I mean if rates only fell by, say, 50 to 100 basis points, or heaven forbid, you know, 25 to 50 basis points. But if you know, you're uncomfortable with the RBA cash rate, you know, sitting somewhere between 3.35% and 4.35% and possibly go to 5%, then you probably need to make some changes.
Yeah, I think it's really challenging. We talk about rates all the time in an economic context, and you and I and anyone else in markets are reading about rates all the time, but you forget that the general public are not looking at this stuff daily. They're looking at it, you know, every now and then on the front page of a newspaper, or it's coming past them on social media. And so they're not getting the sort of daily changes in view. With all of that in context, then, one last question for you. Where are you looking for opportunities for fixed income investors? This is, as I said, it's an asset class a lot of our guys don't or haven't given a lot of thought to. They are now, that's for sure. What are you looking at?
Yeah, we continue to see really interesting opportunities in Aussie bonds, US bonds, and European bonds. We trade, you know, US dollars, euros, sterling, Aussie dollars in the market known as credit, which means basically bank bonds, insurer bonds, and corporate bonds that are highly rated, that have strong liquidity, and which in our assessment have very low to negligible default risks. We also trade Aussie government bonds, so we are seeing opportunities in the Aussie government bond market, so mispricings in that market. When we exploit a mispricing, it's kind of the Westpac analogy. So, you know, Westpac's issuing today, we now know, and so they've priced the deal during this conversation. They're issuing at 1.88 percentage points above the bank bill swap rate. So the interest rate is actually, I think I misspoke earlier, it's 6.23% that you'll be picking up on that. And fair value is a little tighter, that somewhere between 180 and 185. And there's an opportunity there. There's a little mispricing that we can exploit. So we're seeing, interestingly, opportunities in the what we call the new issue market. It's like the IPO market for bonds. We regularly see concessions or discounts or extra interest rate margins that issuers are happy to pay to encourage investors to buy the bonds. And we're, you know, in the first 2 months of the year, I think we bought and sold 82 new issues, so more than one a day. And we're seeing those opportunities in all global markets. As I mentioned, we're also seeing just secondary or in the market itself, mispricings in the Aussie Commonwealth government bond market. So that remains quite attractive to us. In terms of stuff that's possibly more digestible and user-friendly to this audience in respect to the outright levels of interest rates, what we would say is we like the bank's senior ranking bonds. So I have a fund called the Floating Rate High Yield Fund, and that really invests heavily in bank bonds. And you know, the current yield on that fund is about 8%. But a year ago, it's interesting to look at how our portfolio composition has shifted. A year ago, that fund was two-thirds invested in bank subordinated bonds, not hybrids, but bank subordinated bonds, so known as T2 bonds, and one-third invested in bank senior. We've flipped that over time. So right now we're two-thirds in bank senior bonds and one-third tier two bonds. But we do like bank senior paper, and that's because bank senior has been trading on credit spreads that are wider than their long-term historical ranges or heuristics. Bank tier two is also trading a little wide of some of the long-term ranges, but not as much as bank senior. Bank T2's, you know, still, I think, got a role in a portfolio, but it's not necessarily as compelling as senior ranking bonds. In the hybrid market, it's very interesting. Normally bank hybrids, so here I'm talking about, and when I talk about those levels, I always have in mind a five-year major bank senior bond or a five-year major bank tier two bond. And in the case of hybrids, I'll talk about five-year major bank hybrids on the ASX. So they normally pay you about 3.25 to 3.5 percentage points above BBSW or the bank bill swap rate as a margin. Right now, they're only paying 2.45 percentage points above BBSW. So that margin is very skinny. The all-time post-global financial crisis tights for hybrid spreads or hybrid margins are around 200 basis points or 2 percentage points above BBSW. So we're not far off that level. The all-in yield's attractive nonetheless, because you know, you're basically getting about 6.7% interest. So that's still an all-in yield that is superior to T2 bonds and senior bonds. So if you look for yield, then hybrids still have a role to play. In a product we run called HBRD, which is an ETF for beta shares, that's known as the Australian Active Hybrid Fund, but it's the largest active ETF, I think, on the ASX is 2.2 billion in size, but it uniquely has the flexibility to invest in senior bonds, T2 bonds, and hybrids. And I think it's instructive to look at that, over the last 12 months. So over the last year or two, we've cut our hybrid weight from about 100% down to 40%. We've got about 50% in tier two bonds and then about 10% in senior ranking bonds. So that's one of the lowest hybrid weights we've ever had in that particular portfolio. We've gone up the capital structure. That fund is yielding about 6.7% with franking. It's sort of returned something similar over the last 12 months. That floating rate high yield fund is net of fees returned about 11.4% over the last year, so it's yielding 8%. But through finding those mispricings, we've been able to lift that 8% yield to 11.4% after fees through that what we call trading alpha. So in summary, I like senior ranking bonds. I like tier two bonds to a slightly lesser extent. Hybrids we're neutral to negative on. We like the new issue market and we like the government bond market. So I think that there are opportunities aplenty. The main driver of those opportunities is the fact that, you know, the RBA cash rate is at 4.35%. And, you know, on bank bonds, you can get 6 to 7% interest rates, which are the highest they've been in, you know, many, many, many years.
Yeah, I feel quite old being able to remember when they were higher than they are now. It's been a long, long time. Chris, you are prolific in putting out research and commentary. Your funds you've mentioned, where do people go to find out more about you and what you're working on?
You can follow me on Twitter at CJOYE. You can listen to our podcast, the Complexity Premium Podcast, on Podbean. So that's published monthly. And then LinkedIn, so you can follow me on LinkedIn. But, Gemma, thank you so much for the opportunity to engage. It's always awesome speaking to you. You're the best in the business.
Always feel like I'm asking the stupid questions. But Chris Joy from Coolabah Capital, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Gemma.
Thank you so much for listening also. As always, we love hearing from you. We get fantastic feedback. We love getting your questions. We know you want more fixed income and you always love hearing from Chris. Please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au and I look forward to talking to you again soon. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.